It's 10 a.m. in the Eastern time zones, 5 p.m. in Israel, and other times wherever you may be. Welcome back to Dr. Sokolow, who's, of course, taught many times for us in Torah Motion. Always a pleasure to have him. Of course, his first teaching was when we did our 24 books of Tanakh and 24 lectures, and that's you did Sefer Iyov, I believe. So right away, somebody takes us to Sefer Iyov. You know, that's they got some expertise here, and then we asked him to give a course in the Haftarot, which he did for the year, but we did not do the Haftarot of the Yamim Noraim. So for the next 6 weeks, Dr. Sokolow will be going over, I think, most of the Haftarot. We'll be reading in Chodesh, you know, Tishrei. So it's a pleasure to welcome back. And I just want to thank the sponsors of today's class, Cheshki and Devorah Rubin, in memory of their fathers, Chaim Fried, Chaim Ben Menashe Meir, and Chaim Rubin, Chaim Ben Yecheskel Shraga. May they're in the Shaman Havaliyah and may be blessed with healthy and long lives and Shidur good news. Okay, Dr. Sokolow, it's all yours.
Thank you so very much. Good morning to everybody. It's nice to see some familiar faces, or in the absence of faces, some familiar screen names. I'd like to start with a bit of an introduction, with a small apology to those of you who might actually remember the introduction that we gave to the class on Haftarot that took place, I guess, largely during the critical months of COVID. So even if you were here and you don't remember, it's not your fault. So we'll be okay.
Hadran Alach introduction, Hadran Alach introduction, right?
Yes. Okay. So with that, let me share the screen with you. And, okay. Not this screen. We can get rid of this because we're already signed in. But let's make it this screen. Okay, and come on. Where is it? Ah, okay, good. Finally made its way. There's a little bit more here than there is on the things that are posted. Because no matter how hard I try, there's always something that seems to come up at the last minute. So what's not on your source sheets is the first entry here. Those of you who've listened in on classes of mine before know that I have a rather pronounced inclination towards grammar and philology. I thought that an appropriate way to start would be with an examination of the word haftarah. So the word haftarah comes from the shoresh pei tet resh that we're most familiar with in its legal or judicial meaning, and that is that if somebody is found innocent of the commission of a particular crime, then they're called patur, as opposed to guilty, which is chayav. So we can there pretty much understand that patur, or the shoresh pei tet resh, is the opposite of aleph samach, of chet yod bet, or perhaps even of aleph samach resh, in a sense of being patur or asur. Okay, le asur means to tie somebody up. Right. You remember that when Joseph was in prison, it was called Beit HaAsurim. So literally the word Asur means to be tied up. That's why something that is prohibited is called Asur, because in a sense you're supposed to feel restrained from being able to do it. Okay. So obviously the opposite of restraint is freedom from restraint. Therefore you see that basically the root meaning of the Shoresh Pei Tet Resh is either to open, to break open, to separate, to remove, or to set free. And then the dictionary, because it is a dictionary, lists the variety of meanings or nuances that the Shoresh takes when it's used in its different forms, in its different conjugations. So in the simple conjugation, the kal, again, to set free. In the nif'al, which is somewhat of a reflexive form, it means to be exempted or to be set free. Or, in a phrase that many of us may be acquainted with, a euphemism in Hebrew for somebody who is deceased is niftar. And as you see here in the dictionary, it's really an abbreviation for the phrase niftar min ha'olam, literally to be departed, to be freed from this world. Okay. Now, the use that we're most interested in is the final entry in the dictionary, the hif'il. Right? And there you see it has generally three broad meanings: to open wide, to exempt, or to conclude. And it is in the sense of conclusion, as we'll see when we look at some more classical sources, it is in the sense of conclusion that the reading that accompanies the weekly Torah reading, the reading from Nevi'im, from prophets, that accompanies the week's Torah reading, is in a sense a conclusion. Okay, so you can see of all of the different Hebrew forms that the dictionary cites, the one that I highlighted is haftarah. Okay, and in this sense, we get the definition or the description of haftarah from a rather good source. It's a single volume. It's called the Oxford Dictionary of the Jewish Religion. It was published somewhere about 30 years ago, if I'm not mistaken. Although it is a single volume, they did a rather good choice of who the contributors were. These are people who were very knowledgeable in their own fields, but had a particular knack for being able to reduce long and complicated ideas into a rather simple and abbreviated form. So under the entry for Haftarah, they say as follows, as you can see, the custom of conducting regular public readings from the prophets, from Nevi'im, goes back to the Second Temple period, possibly to the time of the Chashmonaim. It has been suggested that it was introduced during a period of persecution, that of Antiochus Epiphanes, that was the ruler of Syria, the Greek ruler of Syria, whose downfall we celebrate every year during the holiday of Chanukah. And it tells us that during this time, the public reading of the Torah was forbidden. Therefore, the public reading of the Torah was forbidden, but ostensibly the public reading of Nevi'im was permissible. Therefore, the purpose was to conclude the reading of the Torah, the main instrument for educating the people, with words of consolation and promises of messianic redemption. So that, they say, was at least historically the original purpose of the Haftarah. In later times, that is when Torah reading was again permissible, the Haftarah portion was no longer necessarily a prophecy of consolation or of messianic redemption, but it was suited instead to the occasion of its recitation. Therefore, pretty much what we saw during the year that we studied the Haftarot of the weekly portions is that the Haftarah on any particular Shabbat has some sort of association to it, usually a thematic association, okay? And on festivals, the Haftarah is connected in some way to the day of the festival itself. Now, obviously, we're going to talk about the Haftarot of Rosh Hashanah, Yom HaKippurim, and Sukkot. So clearly, we're looking for connections, not between the Torah reading per se of Rosh Hashanah, although that may very well be a theme, but we're looking at least for some sort of link between the Haftarah and the holiday itself. Now, where does the Oxford Dictionary of the Jewish Religion get its information from? It gets its information from a variety of classical sources. So here we have one of the earliest and certainly one of the most authoritative discussions of the purpose or the history of the Haftarah. It comes from a commentary on the Siddur that was written by a 13th century Spanish scholar, whose name is usually conventionally pronounced as the Abu Darham, but it really is Abu Darham. Darham is a unit of currency that was used in the Muslim world, and essentially an Abu Darham is pretty much a way of saying, do you remember the old joke, but what do the letters PhD stand for? Right, it's supposed to stand for Papa Has Dough. Right? So Abu Darham is a way of saying somebody who possesses wealth. That doesn't necessarily mean that this particular sage was wealthy. It could simply mean that he came from a wealthy family. Okay. In any event, he wrote that the Torah scroll, well, when complete reading the Torah, right, the Torah scroll is rolled up, and we read the, oh, look at that, there's even a typographical error here, the Haftarah. It must be of the same subject as the day's parasha. Why do we read the Haftarah from the prophets? Because a decree was passed that Israel should not read the Torah, apparently in allusion to that period of persecution under Antiochus. And in lieu of the seven people who would be called for the Torah reading, and since we read no fewer than three verses for each person who's called to the Torah, then the decree was to read at least 21 verses from the prophets. However, if the subject that is discussed in the Haftarah is completed in fewer than 21 verses, such as the Haftarah of Shabbat Shuva, the Shabbat between Rosh Hashanah and Yom HaKippurim, that will be one of our subjects in this series of classes, then the Haftarah does not have to be 21 verses long. It can be fewer than 21 verses. And he continues and he says, why therefore is it called a Haftarah? Because with the Haftarah, one takes leave of the Torah reading. Now here, I simply want to remind you of the line that appears at the very top of the page that you may recognize from the Haggadah, which is Ein maftirin achar ha-pesach afikoman, which, forget about the Greek word afikoman, it basically means that after the Korban Pesach is eaten, that's the end of the meal. Right? So in essence, it's calling it the last course. It's the last course because with it, one, as it were, takes one's leave from the Seder meal. Therefore, the Abu Darham tells us that the reading from the Nevi'im that accompanies the weekly Torah reading is called a Haftarah because with its reading, we take our leave of the Torah reading. Then he tells us that Rabbeinu Tam, a very important sage in France in the 12th century, gave a different reason. He said that it's called a Haftarah because the Talmud says that once the Torah scroll is open, it's prohibited to speak. That's not just the opinion of Rabbeinu Tam, it's the opinion of just about all Jewish legal authorities. It's codified in the Shulchan Aruch and it isn't challenged by any later authorities. But it happens, at least in my experience, to be one of those things that isn't particularly well known or not particularly well observed by most congregations. But in any event, since it's prohibited to speak while the Torah scroll is being read from, therefore, when the reading of the Torah is completed and once again it's permissible to talk, therefore, Rabbeinu Tam says that's why it's called the Haftarah. It's called the Haftarah in the sense of commencing because, as it were, once again, we're given a green light to speak to one another. There are other opinions, as you see cited here. It's in the source sheet, and I won't take up any more time with it. Just simply to introduce, however, the very last source, and that is a book called Chazon HaMikra. The visionary portion of the Bible, and usually that's a reference to the what we call the Nevi'im Acharonim, the three rather large books of prophets, those of Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, and Yechezkel. They're not the only ones that include visions, but generally they're the ones that are amongst the most visionary. And he entitled the book Chazon HaMikra because it is a book that Rabbi Jacobson wrote on the Haftarot, one of the few books that actually is dedicated to the Haftarot. And just simply to call our attention to the fact that if traditionally, historically, the Haftarah accompanied the weekly Torah reading, then it should be that in the land of Israel, where the custom originated, and where until the High Middle Ages, the custom continued to be that they completed a cycle of Torah reading, not annually, but only every 3 years, what scholars call a triennial cycle, as opposed to an annual cycle, right? That if that's the case, then there ought to be three times as many haftarot. And indeed, he tells us that the triennial cycle that was maintained in the land of Israel through the high Middle Ages has naturally three times as many haftarot as we have in our tradition of an annual cycle. And indeed, the list, if you're curious and you want to know what were the haftarot that accompanied, that we no longer recite, then they actually were published by a scholar named Adolf Buchler in the Jewish Quarterly Review in 1906. And an interesting thing is that instead of referring to them as haftarot, he cites a medieval source that refers to them by the Aramaic word ashlamta, in which you can recognize the root shin lamid mem, meaning shalem, to be complete. And if indeed they were considered a completion of the Torah reading rather than an appendix, a supplement to the Torah reading, then one can argue that they were considered an integral part of the liturgy, and that arguably Torah reading was incomplete without its accompanying haftarah. Okay. And I think that is a pretty adequate introduction. And with that, we'll switch the screen to the haftarah of the first day of Rosh Hashanah. Now, a word to those of you who aren't online now, and that is that I'm going to stray a bit from, not from the sequence of the haftarot that are listed in the advertisement, but for example, it gave me only one day today to do both haftarot of Rosh Hashanah. Now, for all I know, in Toronto, they only have one day of Rosh Hashanah and have only one haftarah. So it could be that that's why I was only allocated today for Rosh Hashanah. But since at least in New York, or at least on the Upper West Side, we have haftarot on the 2 days of Rosh Hashanah, I don't think that we're going to have the time to get to the haftarah, the second day of Rosh Hashanah today. So if we don't, right, then we'll certainly get to it next week. So as I said,
that's
this
fine,
is not for any
way.
Of you who are online, because you'll see it soon enough. It's for anybody who's not online.
Dr. Sokolow, I had no problem if you wanted to two days Rosh Hashanah. We'll talk about that later. Instead of a week, that's fine. But anyway, today, Rosh Hashanah, day number one, Chana.
Of course.
Rabbi, okay. In Toronto, we have 2 days of Rosh Hashanah.
Absolutely. Everybody has 2 days of Rosh Hashanah. Even in the land of Israel, where they observe only one day of the three pilgrimage festivals, only one day at the beginning and end of Sukkot and Pesach, and only one day of Shavuot, even in the land of Israel, they observe 2 days of Rosh Hashanah. And in fact, it's an intriguing question that is raised. It's a hypothetical question that's raised in some halachic works, and that is, in the Messianic age, when we are no longer in doubt about the accuracy of our calendar, which parenthetically is why we observe 2 days of at the beginning or at the end of Pesach or etc., at least in the diaspora, okay, outside of the land of Israel, because we're just simply not certain about our calendar, what will be in the Messianic age when there will not be any doubt about the calendar? So will we continue to keep 2 days of the pilgrimage festivals? No. Why? Not only because we will have no doubt about the calendar, but simply because in the Messianic age, there won't be any Jews living outside the land of Israel, right? One of the signs of the Messianic age is arguably the ingathering of the exiles. So if we're all going to be ingathered, right, then there won't be a problem of how many days we keep. Okay. But a more intriguing hypothetical question is, what about Rosh Hashanah? Do we keep 2 days of Rosh Hashanah today because of the halachic principle of Sveka Diyoma, because we're simply not uncertain about which of the 2 days is really the first day of the month of Tishrei? And if that's the case, then arguably in the Messianic age, when all these questions will be resolved and all of these doubts will be eliminated, then arguably Rosh Hashanah would, like the holidays, revert to being a festival of only a single day. There is, however, another opinion that says that no, even in the Messianic age, and even in the land of Israel, there will always be 2 days of Rosh Hashanah. Why? Because the law is, and it's actually something that we will see in practice this year, right? The first of the 2 days of Rosh Hashanah, which even on our calendars, right, is always marked as the first day of Tishrei. It's not like your usual 2 days of Rosh Chodesh, as we had, for example, just a week ago, where the first day of Rosh Chodesh was really the 30th day of the previous month, and only the second day of Rosh Chodesh is marked as the first day of the subsequent month. When it comes to the holiday of Rosh Hashanah, even the first day of Rosh Hashanah is already the first day of the month of Tishrei. Okay, but this year, as you know, the first day of the month of Tishrei falls on Shabbat. And on Shabbat, it is prohibited to blow the shofar. It's a rabbinic prohibition. Okay, now, if it's only a rabbinic prohibition, then one could argue that in the Messianic age, right, we will be instructed once again by prophets, and prophets can overrule the rabbis. So it could very well be that in the Messianic age, even if Rosh Hashanah were to fall on Shabbat, we would blow the shofar. But there's another opinion that says that actually not blowing the shofar on Shabbat may have been historically a rabbinic enactment, but it actually has its root in the Torah. Because if you pay attention, I'm not going to tell it to you now, but you're going to have to pay attention to the Torah reading on the 2 days of Rosh Hashanah. But you will see that there are two references to blowing the shofar on Rosh Hashanah. One is an active imperative to blow the shofar. The other is formulated as Yom Zichron Teruah Yihyeh Lachem. It will be a day of the recollection, remembrance of blowing the shofar. So there is an argument that says that the Torah already foresaw the prospect of having a day of Rosh Hashanah on which the shofar would not be blown, namely on Shabbat, and therefore having 2 days of Rosh Hashanah, so that even if the first day is a Shabbat and we don't blow the shofar, we should still have an extra day of Rosh Hashanah on which we do blow the shofar, that this isn't just a rabbinic arrangement, but it's actually a Torah arrangement, and therefore it would arguably persevere even in the Messianic age. So you're all invited to tune in the Messianic age and to see which of the two opinions we're actually going to follow. I'm sure that Rabbi Kelman can somehow program it into the Torah in Motion calendar to make sure that we're all back together in the Messianic age to see which of the two opinions about Shofar and Rosh Hashanah we're going to follow. Okay. With that, we go to the first day of Rosh Hashanah. And the first day of Rosh Hashanah, the Haftarah of the first day, as you can see, is from the very beginning, the very first chapter of the first half of the book of Samuel, what we call Shmuel Aleph, right? Not that there were two prophets named Samuel, but just that the book of Samuel was long enough, right, that simply for reasons of study or teaching, the rabbis divided it in half. Right? As they also divided the book of Kings, Malachim, in half, okay, and as they actually divided the book of Ezra in half. Now, the curious thing is that since the book of Ezra actually features two significant prophets, Ezra and Nehemiah, then somehow the second half of the book of Ezra got a name of its own. So instead of being called Ezra 1 and Ezra 2, the second half of the book of Ezra is called the book of Nehemiah. But you can know that it's not really an independent book, but it's only the second half of another biblical book. by counting the 24 canonical books of the Bible. If you count Ezra and Nehemiah separately, you're going to end up with 25 canonical books rather than 24. Okay. So, the book of Shmuel is arguably not the first book in that section of Tanakh called Nevi'im, called prophets, because that already began with the book of Joshua and continued through the book of Judges. But strictly speaking, Shmuel himself, Samuel himself, was at least the first significant prophet of the age of prophets. Not that Joshua wasn't a prophet, but it's curious that Jewish tradition, or at least rabbinic tradition, generally does not refer to Joshua as a prophet. You don't find sources referring to Yehoshua HaNavi, right? Although, while you do always find sources referring to Shmuel HaNavi, okay? That's why I started off here with the opening Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, the one that tells us a bit about the chain of transmission of the Jewish tradition. Moshe kibel Torah mi Sinai. Moses, of course, received the Torah from God on Mount Sinai. Umisarah lihoshua. And Moses turned the Torah over to, he transferred it, he transmitted it to Yehoshua. And Yehoshua transmitted it to the Zekenim, to the elders, Uzekenim l'Nevi'im. So, between Moses and the prophets, we have not one, but two intermediate links in our chain of tradition. The first one is given a proper name, Yehoshua. Okay? And that's by virtue of the fact that at the very end of the book of Deuteronomy, and we're reminded at the very beginning of the book of Joshua, that Moses taught Joshua, right, the Torah. That whatever it was that Moses had learned about the Torah, he conveyed to Joshua. Therefore, Joshua was a rather singular figure, okay? And therefore, he occupies his own independent link in the chain of tradition. Joshua, however, as we know from the beginning of the book of Shofetim, the beginning of the book of Judges, did not have an individual successor, right? Unlike Moshe, who was able to appoint his own successor, Yehoshua did not appoint a successor. If you look at the very end, the last chapter, 24 of the book of Joshua, you'll see that Joshua was succeeded by Pinchas, right? And Pinchas was succeeded by anonymous elders, Zekenim. So arguably these Zekenim are the ones who succeeded Yehoshua, right? And they probably were the ones who were in charge of the Jewish people during that lengthy period of time between the death of Yehoshua and the birth of Shmuel. So that Shmuel then is the first of the Nevi'im who received the transmission of the tradition from the Zekenim, from the elders. Okay. Unevi'im, the prophets themselves, Misarua l'anshei Knesset HaGedolah, and the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah are not exclusive of prophets. Among the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, the men of the Great Assembly, which met during the 70 years of the Babylonian exile and continued on into the early days of the Second Temple period, there were among them several prophets. If we needed to name them, they certainly included the last three of the prophets of that era, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. So, basically, as I wrote, having passed from the Torah through the books of Yehoshua and Shofetim, reflecting the era of the elders, now, in the beginning of the book of Samuel, we enter the era of the Nevi'im, the era of the prophets. Now, some of what we read at the beginning of the book of Samuel is familiar, right? And that is, once again, we have a lead character, just as we had during one of the closing chapters of the book of Judges, who lives on Mount Ephraim, the Ephraim hill country, that is to the north of Jerusalem. If you look on a modern map, and you look on the front page of the of either the New York Times or the, Toronto Tribune Mail, Toronto Mail, isn't it?
The Globe and Mail.
Globe and Mail.
Star in the Globe and Mail, or Toronto.
Globe and Mail. If you look back on the front page of newspapers about a month ago, when the Israeli army on a somewhat daily basis was making raids into refugee camps in the vicinity of the city of Jenin, then Jenin, like nearby Shechem, is situated in the Ephraim Hill country. And the Ephraim Hill country plays a very crucial role in some of the most famous or notorious episodes in the early history of the settlement of the Jewish people in the land of Israel. So once again, we have a lead character who lives on Har Ephraim, Mount Ephraim. You see that in the opening verse of the Haftarah. Vayhi ish achad min haramatayim, tsofim me Har Ephraim, that there was a certain man. The reference here is not to Samuel, but to his father Elkanah, who is described as coming from a place called Ramatayim Tsofim in the Ephraim Hill country. Now, Ramah is the name of a camp, of course. Ramah means a height. Okay, Laharim, to raise up. Therefore, Ramah is a height. Okay, now, Tsofer is a lookout. Right? Now, logically, where are you going to station a lookout? You're going to station a lookout, right, on a high point. Okay. So arguably, whatever hilltops in the Ephraim mountain country were the highest or among the highest, so that these were the places where lookouts were posted, okay, could be called Ramatayim Tsofim. Ramatayim in the dual would seem to imply that there were two such places, okay? So if you want, the two highest peaks, or two of the highest peaks in the Ephraim Hill country, right, were the places where lookouts were posted. And that is where Elkanah, the father of Samuel, lived. Okay. Now, if you are already familiar with the Haftarah of the second day of Rosh Hashanah, okay, then you already know what I'm going to draw your attention to, but I actually have it here for that purpose. You don't have it in the sources yet, but here it is, okay? The concluding portion of the Haftarah of the second day of Rosh Hashanah, coming from the 31st chapter of the book of Yirmiyahu, says, Ko amar Hashem, right? Thus says the Lord, Kol barama nishma, that there is a voice, okay? If you want to be a bit more paraphrastic or interpretive, it's not just a voice, it's a moaning voice, right? A wailing voice, okay? Because it's called Nehi Bechi Tamrurim, a weeping, a bitter weeping voice, okay? And where is it emanating from? It is emanating from the Ramah. Okay. And whose voice is it? Says the prophet. Rachel Mivaka al Baneha. It's the voice of the matriarch Rachel, right, bemoaning the loss of her children. So the question that we're not going to answer today, but we will answer next week when we look in greater detail at the Haftarah of the second day of Rosh Hashanah, is whether the Ramah that's featured in the Haftarah of the second day of Rosh Hashanah is the same as the Ramah that's featured in the Haftarah of the first day of Rosh Hashanah. Okay? So those of you who will be with us next week, keep it in mind. Okay. So, again, Elkanah, our lead character, lives in the Ephraim Hill country. And once again, there are traces of a link to Beit Lechem in the fact that the Pasuk designates him as an Ephrati. Now, here too, just as in Ramah, right, it could be a double entendre, the word Ephrati is open to two different interpretations, okay? In the word Ephrati, you can obviously see pretty much all of the letters of the word on the previous line, Ephraim. The Aleph, the Fe, the Resh, right? They're all the same. So one could certainly conclude that an Ephrati is simply another way of saying somebody from the tribe of Ephraim. So isn't it redundant? Not necessarily. The first half of the Pasuk told us that this character named Elkanah lived in the Ephraim Hill country. But just because he lived in the Ephraim Hill country doesn't necessarily mean that he was from the tribe of Ephraim. Therefore, it could be that the Pasuk is not at all being redundant, but that the first use of Har Ephraim is to situate him in a place. The second use of Ephraim in Ephrati is to situate him ethnically. He didn't only live in the Ephraim Hill country, but he was a member of the tribe of Ephraim. On the other hand, we're talking about a period of Jewish history that's not all that far removed from the original conquest of the land of Israel. Now, you may remember from the Torah reading of not too many weeks ago, and if you've forgotten, don't worry, the Torah will remind you in another couple of weeks, right? That there was a character named Tzlofchad who had five daughters and no sons, and his relatives were very worried about what would happen to his portion, to his share, his allotment in the land of Israel if it couldn't pass to his daughters, but instead went to his sons-in-law, who might very well come from different tribes. And the Torah's answer at the time was that the daughters of Tzlofchad should only marry within their tribe. So we're talking about a period of time in which there was a considerable amount of intra-marriage, that people were mostly focused on marrying within their tribe, within their clan, okay? And that was because they lived next to each other. So I could say, if you've already told me that he lives in the territory of the tribe of Ephraim, right, then it seems to me that it's pretty reasonable to assume that he was from the tribe of Ephraim, in which case the use of the word Ephrati would in fact be redundant. And rather than being redundant, let's see if it could mean something else. Well, the other designation of Ephrat is that it seems to be another name for the city of Beit Lechem. You may recall that when Jacob and his wives and his children were returning to the land of Israel from his sojourn in Aram, in Aramea, okay, Rachel died along the way, okay? And it says that she was buried Bederech Ephrat. She was buried on the road to Ephrat, Ki Beit Lechem. So if Ephrat can also mean, in addition to somehow sharing, you know, the meaning of the substantive of the word Ephraim, is also another name for the city of Beit Lechem, then it's conceivable that we're talking about a character who, despite the fact that he lived in the territory of the tribe of Ephraim, right, might have himself been from a different tribe. He might have been from the tribe of Judah, because the city of Beit Lechem was in the territory of the tribe of Yehuda. Okay. Now, v'lo shtei nashim, it says at the opening of verse 2, that he's married to two women, okay? Not our first acquaintance with someone who was married to two women, right? Abraham was married to two women. Yaakov at a certain point in time was married to only two women. Moses, right, might have been married to two women if, in fact, the Cushite woman, of the 12th chapter of Bimidbar is someone other than his Midianite wife, Tzipporah. Okay. And since it wasn't until the 11th century in Germany that Jewish law prohibited polygamy, right? Bigamy is just simply the minimal form of polygamy, right? Bigamy, gamos in is Greek for a spouse, right? Bigamy means two spouses. Polygamy means multiple spouses. Okay, since it wasn't until the eleventh century that polygamy was prohibited. Somehow, I should say parenthetically, it seems that when you say polygamy, you think about it in anthropological terms, right? And it has no particular value, right? You know that once upon a time, you know, people married lots of, you know. Somehow, when you say bigamy, it sounds pejorative. Okay, so since it wasn't until then that polygamy was prohibited, not surprising to find maybe even many, maybe even statistically most men were married to more than one woman. Right? We have no evidence of it. Right? And we don't know about it. We don't know whether it was the norm or not, simply because the scripture, the Tanakh, simply doesn't share that information with us. Okay. But in any event, he's married to two women. And when we read, as we will quickly, about the vicissitudes of one of his wives, of Hannah, right, and the eventual birth under somewhat unusual circumstances, or certainly not average circumstances, of the child Shmuel, it's somewhat reminiscent of the birth of Moshe Rabbeinu. Right? Certainly in the way in which, having mentioned Elkanah, he pretty much recedes into the background, so that the main characters of the story remain the two women, Hannah and Penina, again in a narrative manner that's reminiscent of the story of the birth of Moses, in which Amram isn't even named, let alone recedes into the background, leaving us with Yocheved and Miriam to pretty much be the main actors. Okay. Now, of particular interest here is the nature of the relationship between Elkanah's wives. If you take a look at Pasuk Vav, right, in the following, it's highlighted there. Okay. It's described as her rival, Tzara, right, her rival, ki asata gam ka'as, vexed her or angered her grievously. Why? Ba'avur. Because Sagar Hashem Ba'ad Rachma, because she was barren, because literally God has closed her womb. Okay? Now, it can be read in two different ways. According to the conventional reading, Penina was mocking Hannah's infertility, right? Thus increasing Hannah's despair. Okay? This reflected, as I wrote, in the beginning, first half of Rashi's commentary on the verse, in which Rashi has Penina saying to Hannah, did you buy your older son a coat today? Did you buy a shirt for your younger son? Right, knowing fully well that she had no children. Okay. An unconventional reading, however, reflected in the continuation of the same commentary by Rashi, showing us that he was as ambivalent about it as we might be, imputes to Penina a noble intent, and that is, in order to make her complain, because in those days, how did religious people voice their complaints? They voiced their complaints in prayer to God. So in order to inspire, or if you wish, even to provoke Hannah into praying to God to resolve her infertility, right? Penina decided to anger her, to vex her, right? Therefore, Penina comes out of the story looking good rather than looking bad. Okay. Now, the story itself, okay, continues, and it tells us how Elkanah and his family would go annually to Shiloh for the festivals. Shiloh in those days being the place where the Mishkan, the tabernacle, was situated on a reasonably permanent basis. And therefore, it was in its day and age the equivalent of what Jerusalem and the temple would become in a slightly later age. And therefore, it was the place to which people would go for the pilgrimage festivals. And Hannah took advantage of one such visit in order to pour her heart out before God and to pray for a child. And she says, and you can take a look in verse 11 here, okay, that's the last verse in this section, okay, I'll highlight it, okay, that she made a vow. And she made a vow to God, and she said, Im ra'o tir'eh bo'oni amatecha, if indeed God, you will witness the suffering of your servant, of that would be herself, uzchartani, right? And you will take note of me. V'lo tishkach et amatecha, right? This is your typical redundant fashion. You remember me by not forgetting me. Okay? V'natata la'amatcha zera anashim. And you will not only make me fertile, but you will enable me to bear a boy child. Then, that's the if clause, right? What's the then clause? Unetativ l'ashem kol yemei chayav, I will devote him to the service of God for his entire life. And furthermore, umora lo ya'ale al rosho, he will be, to use the Torah term, a nazir. That is to say, he will be rather special in respect to the fact that he won't have his hair cut. Okay. And now we read that as it came to pass, as she prayed before God, okay, that the Eli, who was the equivalent of the Kohen Gadol at the time, saw her praying, right? But he didn't hear her voice. Now, it's likely that he didn't hear her voice because he was old and hard of hearing. In fact, we're going to read about him, well, if we will continue past this Haftarah, we'd read about him that he was rather old and rather hard of hearing. So he was also hard of seeing. He was somewhat blind. So it's likely that he didn't hear her, not because she wasn't enunciating, but because he simply couldn't hear her. I make the point only because the Talmud, particularly in Masechet Brachot, uses the figure of Hannah to teach us a good deal of what we know as the basic laws of prayer. And since one of the basic laws of prayer is that someone who is praying has to be able at least to hear him or herself enunciating, articulating the words, then I'm assuming that Hannah spoke in such a way that if you had really listened carefully, you could have heard her voice. Therefore, I'm assuming that the reason that Eli didn't hear her was likely, in the greater likelihood, simply because he was hard of hearing. But in any event, he first mistakes her for someone who is simply mumbling or rambling, and he is critical of her, and she corrects him, and he apologizes, and as part of his apology, he basically seconds her prayer to God. And as a result of her praying, and as a result of Eli's seconding her prayer, we get to the last line in this section, that Vayilat Kufot Hayamim, that it came to pass after a certain period of time, or it could be at the same time in the coming year, that she bore a son, and she named him Shmuel Ki Mehashem She'iltiv, because, as it were, I have asked him of God. There were occasions on which I would teach this to students, and I would start the lesson off by saying, Shaul, King Saul, and the prophet Samuel were switched at birth. Because if you take a look, when Hannah names her son, She names him on account of the fact that he was Mihashem She'iltiv. I have asked him of God. How do you name a child who is the answer to a prayer? The word is Sha'ul, answered of or asked of. So I used to joke that Saul and Samuel, the reason that they developed such a close relationship is because they were switched at birth. A couple of words quickly about Chano's prayer. We'll do more of this next week when we also take up the Haftarah of the second day of Rosh Hashanah. But I do want to point to something about Chano's prayer. And that is that it is not the first time, and it's certainly not the only time in the Bible that we find the use of the word titpalel, okay? But it's an opportunity to say something about the word tefillah, particularly since it plays such a crucial role, not only throughout what we call the high holy days, the Yamim HaNoraim, but it plays a particularly central or focal role in one of the more focal prayers of the Yamim HaNoraim, the one in the Ashkenazic liturgy that is called Unetane Tokef. In your machzor, and I can say this without even knowing what machzor you use, I'm absolutely certain that in its rendition of the Netane Tokef Piyot, in the Musaf of the 2 days of Rosh Hashanah, and again on the Musaf of Yom HaKippurim, there are three words that are centered on the page and appear in a much larger font than the rest of the prayer. And those three words are teshuvah, tefillah, and tzedakah. And I'm also sure that if your machzor has an English translation, the word tefillah is rendered as prayer. I'm sorry, teshuvah is rendered as repentance. Tefillah is rendered as prayer. And tzedakah is rendered as charity. And I'm here to tell you today, and I'll be glad to do it in greater detail next week if anybody wants me to, that none of those three translations is correct, and none of them is really appropriate for the purpose that that prayer is supposed to serve. The word repentance happens to share an etymology with the word penalty and with the word penitentiary. A penitence is a punishment. Okay? When we repent, we're not being punished. We're repenting in order to avoid punishment. The shoresh, the root of the word teshuvah, is shin vavet, which means to return or to do over. I like to translate teshuvah as do over. It's an opportunity to try again. It's a second chance. The root of prayer, the etymology of the word prayer, certainly those of you in Quebec, right, you Francophones know, prier in French means to beseech, it means to ask. The meaning of the word prayer is an asking, right? In Hebrew, it would be bakasha. Bakasha is an element of, it's an ingredient of tefillah, but by no means is it synonymous with the entire enterprise of tefillah. Coming from the root pe lamid lamid, which means to judge, lehit palel in the reflexive means to judge oneself. In a single word, it would be introspection. And as for charity, charity comes from the Latin root caritas. Caritas means love. And it reflects a Christian notion, which is that the reason that I give alms to the poor is because I want to show my love for an unfortunate creature. The word tzedakah in Hebrew comes from the root that means just. I give tzedakah not because I necessarily love the unfortunate person, although that wouldn't be a bad thing, but I do it because it's the just thing to do. If I have more than my fellow, then it is a matter of justice that I share with him or her. And with that, I will pause and see what we have on the chat. And as I said, we'll pick up here with Chana's prayer next week, in which time we will also go into the Haftarah of the second day. And remember again, one of the things that we're going to look for is whether the Ramah of 1 Samuel 1 is the same Ramah as Jeremiah 31, and whether the Ephrat of 1 Samuel 1 is Ephraim or whether it is Beit Lechem. And that too would ostensibly connect it to Jeremiah 31. But we'll get to that in due time. Sources are here, and sources are here, and thank you very much. Appreciate it. Sources are still here. Is there anything else there, Rabbi? Have you looked at it? Any? It's a different thing. It's nothing. It's not the calendar per se. As I said, it seems to be the idea of being able to accommodate both a period of time in which the shofar can be blown, as well as a period of time in which we can only recall the blowing of the shofar. Tosef has changed the Israel 1 day of Rosh Hashanah. No, 2 days Tosefist. No. Rosh Hashanah, 1 day, 2 days back to then, same thing. Rabbi Zevin, right? Hamoadim b'halacha. Not possible most men to have been married to two women, more like some men. I don't know. If modern demography is anything like ancient demography, then there were always more women than men. So I don't know why men. Also, if you think about it, how did the demography of the Jewish people, how did the population increase so dramatically over a relatively short amount of time if men weren't having many children with many wives? I don't know. Then Elimelech, Naomi, who come from Beit Lechem, as I said, Elimelech and Naomi were also from Beit Lechem. We'll get to that next week, the Bethlehem connection. Okay, obviously that ties into the question of, obviously it ties into the question of where is Rachel's tomb? Okay. All right. Yeah, many more men. That's okay. See, people have polygamy into it. Okay, seems to do it. Very good. Rabbi, anything you want to add to
us? Okay, thank you. I'm just thinking, okay, you'll talk about, you didn't talk yet exactly why this was picked for the first day of Rosh Hashanah. You can talk next week because that was one of the questions at the end, if you want to. But thank you very much. 1 p.m., that's in 2 hours, in 2 hours and 2 minutes to be precise. Rabbi Moshe Shulman will begin a ongoing series on Kohelet. We've never talked Kohelet before here on the Torah Motion Zoom channel, so we invite you all to come. I'm sure many of you know Rabbi Shulman. He taught Sefer Daniel last year. He's a wonderful teacher of Tanakh, so he wanted to teach Kohelet, and I said, that's a great idea. So we're starting at 7 weeks, but he told me it'll be more than 7 weeks. But just for the Yontif season, he'll do 7 weeks of Kohelet. So that's at 1 p.m. Tomorrow at 10 a.m., Simi Peters, who's also taught before, will be teaching Sefer Yonah. That's a more classic Sefer for the Yamim Noraim. That will start tomorrow at 10 a.m. And then continuing throughout the week, Parsha on Thursday, my Siddur class on Friday, Rabbi Liebtag. Next Monday, Benny Gesundheit will start his series on the differences in between the Talmud Yerushalmi and Bavli on issues of Tefillah. So that'll be next Monday. I believe he's at 1 p.m. Eastern time, but just take a look at all the emails and make mention. It's not advertised yet. It's nowhere on the website. September 10th, we'll be having like a Yom Iyun from probably 9:15 to 1:30 in the morning. We'll have 8 speakers for half an hour each on issues relating to Yamim Noraim. We have, I think, a great roster. And so be on the lookout for that in the next couple of days. That'll be September 10th. And then I mentioned for those who were here on Sunday, September 9th. Right, great. And September 23rd, which are Saturday nights on the East Coast. Rabbi Liebtag will be giving a shiur on Saturday night. On Slichas night, Rabbi Liebtag will give a shiur at 10 p.m. For those who live on the East Coast, 5 a.m. For those who usher, you got to get up early for that shiur, 5 a.m. in the morning. But you can go to the shiur and then go to the Slichas in the morning. You want to go to Slichas at night. And that'll be, and then he'll do the same thing on Erev Yom Kippur, sort of teach Saturday night on the East Coast. And okay, so that's much of our schedule. There'll be a few more things coming up, but we always like to add a few few surprises. Always happy to listen to any of your ideas and suggestions and critique. And I look forward to learning with everybody. And please invite a friend, and everybody have a wonderful day. Okay, Dr. Sokolo, you got that all down so you can come, and your wife can come to many of our, the wonderful baked meat dress we have around the world.
Indeed.
Yes. Okay. So see you back now. It's back in 2 hours to Rabbi Shulman for Sefer Kohelet. Okay. Same channel. And we'll
thank
see you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Yeah. Okay. Ciao, ciao.